FOMC members in the late 60s, or late 50s and early 60s, they were primarily bankers by training, and they looked at the world as bankers, interest
bankers,
rates,
lawyers, right? Everything. Simchek, for example, who served longer than anybody else on the board.
What was his name?
Simchek. It's a Polish name. He's from Chicago. I'm trying to remember who got him appointed. There was a political debt to him, and that was sort of the payoff. And he served probably 12 years of an unexpired term, and then was appointed for 14 years. He had a lot of time on that. He was, I think, a local government official. I'm a little nice guy, very nice guy. But, you know, no particular training for that kind of position. But sometimes people with good judgment can make better policy makers than people with a lot of formal training who don't have really good. Mr. Leach, case in point, Mr. Leach was a CPA and an accountant and a very tough, a very smart guy, a very tough mind. He wanted to encapsulate everything in just a very few words. And he would get all the economists around the dining room table. They always sat in the same place and questioned them. He never did anything else. You know, we never talked about much. You know, it's occasionally he'd talk about buying a car for his son or something like that. But he always wanted to, he looked at it from every side and wanted to get it completely accurate and very simple, because he was convinced that people couldn't listen to very obtuse statements, and he did right on that. And so he would get down to the very essence of it. And I remember Dave Eastburns telling me one time that he gained a lot of respect for people like Mr. Leach. But I think that intuition was a lot of the guide as to what they did. It is not the kind of precision either you or I like. But, you know, during that period, it was the policy was very good under Bill Martin. Bill Martin was a great leader. He is one of the electromagnetism that led people to respect him, and they had a great deal of affection for him. And he just guided the committee, and he was real interested in the go-around. He never spoke first, as Burns often did, and occasionally did, and Greenspan has done on occasion. As far as I know, there were only two occasions. Mr. Wayne used to say there were only two occasions when he sat fishing, and he had something that was very vital, and he shared this. But they would go around the table, and people would speak in turn, and they went around clockwise one time and counterclockwise the other, and people had these prepared statements. And then at the end, you would have listened to a diverse statement of opinions, and Bill Martin would typically say, well, there's not a lot of disagreement among us today, and he would wrap that up, and nobody ever objected to what he said.
Was he truly forming a consensus, or was he, to some extent, imposing his
view? To some extent, he was imposing his, but it was, people were usually struck by the wisdom of what he said. He was a very smart man. Very astute, and his record shows he had a good understanding of markets, and by some process or another, which is very mysterious, this was really a little black box. He came up with very good policy recommendations, and I don't think there was any resentment about this at all. People realized you had to have a consensus, and what he would state would be about as close to the consensus as you could get, but sometimes slanted easily. Actual consensus of the group.
In general, did people have a sense of what his objectives were, what he wanted to do as a leader?
I think so. I think he placed a great deal of emphasis on price stability, and that was in quite those precise terms in those days, because we wanted the economy growing, and there was greater growth is through controlling inflation. You were looking at all of these things, and you sort of tried to attain all those goals, and fortunately, we pretty well did. during a good part of that period. A lot of it was the times, and a lot of it was just good policy, stumbled upon, I would think, in part by accident. But also, there was an uncanny ability on his part, and a lot of it's not unlike what we're doing now. How do you decide what's the right policy now? He's very much back to the way it was, I think.
But Barton had, of course, been a young man during the Depression, and he had the idea that the Depression had been caused by inflation and speculation in the 1920s. So that must have made him sensitive to inflation in the 50s and 60s, that kind of Fed concern that you have inflation, you have extension of credit for speculative reasons, you have imbalances, and then you get a reaction. I mean, so he really cared about inflation.
Oh, no question about that. And he was a great chairman. You know, I would say Martin was a great chairman, Volcker was a great chairman, and Greenspan was a great chairman. Mm-hmm. And they all have been the money supply. But looking back on it, it may have been that harsh medicine was necessary to bring out the inflation. I don't know. It seemed the right base to pay. You know. But I was not voting for him, but all the other times, including his first two meetings, I just sent it tight of money. But the guy had a lot of courage, and in October 6th, this is following my first two dissents in April and September when we had the so-called change in direction. It really was a change in direction, although we repudiated a lot of it, as you well know. But yeah, I remember his calling, I guess everyone. I didn't know at the time, but he called me and told me what he proposed. Happy day, the only day I've ever voluntarily wanted to miss golf, because we were going to go do what I thought we ought to do. All because of bad policies on our part earlier that made it necessary.
And let's go back to Martin. He came out of the Treasury.
Right.
And went to the Fed.
And he was off of the Accord, you know. So he saw the danger of that. He was a guy who really was responsible for the Accord. And he'd been president of the New York Stock Exchange. His father had been president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. So he'd been steeped in Federal Reserve law for a long time.
Oh, he had to talk to Truman on one side and McCabe on the other side in the Accord, and he had some sense of what was right. It means he couldn't have been doing what Truman and the Treasury thought. He must have had some independent.
He was a very independent man and very persuasive. He did. In convincing people that's what had to be done, a big part of the credit. And this was before I had joined the system. So your knowledge of it would be as good as mine, but my reading and recollection of it, the system would have been a fail of it, but he wouldn't have done anything without the administration agreeing to it.
Paul Douglas
in
Congress must have been very important.
Yeah, the Douglas Report. And we read that back and forth.
And the president of the New York Fed, Alan Sproul. He must have
Sproul.
Been. Sproul.
Sproul.
He must have been important, too.
Yeah, he was a powerful figure. And he had left by the time I started going to open market committee meetings, and Al Hayes.
Hayes had the probably the most concern for international considerations.
I'll give you one little example in 1960, which will show you how much attention was being paid to international issues there. I was really worried about the foreign side of it at all. And people began to think about it. In 1960, I guess it was, Parthenius had just arrived, fresh from teaching graduate international economics at Tulane. And Mr. Leach was president then, and we were all seated around the table in the dining room. And Mr. Leach said in his gruff voice, "What would happen if we devalued the dollar?" What Mr. Leach wanted us to say was that would tend to improve the balance of payments, our balance of payments. He said, "Well, Mr. Leach, that would depend a lot upon the six elasticities involved in foreign trade." He put in and said, "What kind of dang fool monkey talk is that?" And those are his exact words, I think. And we just died laughing about that, because I don't know any graduate student who hadn't read a struggle trying to understand those classes. I never can remember whether there were six or eight. I had that asked on my conference, but I never labeled as much over anything. You know, when you get into the elasticity and of demand for foreign exchange, it's very tricky. It's just not like other elasticity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but Martin was also sensitive, though, to the concerns of the Treasury and the concerns of the White House. He was willing to often to temporize, to accommodate, wasn't he, with depending upon the kinds of pressures he was under from the Treasury.
Bob, I think he was very much of a diplomat, and I think he would discuss things with them. But if you look at what happened to policy, I don't think he really compromised any great extent. I mean,
at the end, in 67, that really marked the break from earlier periods, in that in earlier periods, inflation would rise, and it would even get up to 4%, a number like that. But then the Fed would bring it down. So it fluctuated, but it fluctuated around a relatively low level. But in 67, when we should have stayed with a restrictive monetary policy until we brought the inflation rate down, monetary policy became easy again, and it stayed easy in 68. And that was really the beginning of inflationary.
Well, when did the Vietnam War start?
Well, the buildup started at the end of 65. And Martin knew that fiscal policy was going to be expansionary. And he was hoping that Congress would pass a tax increase. So
there was, butter.
Yeah. So there was a period of time where the Fed and the administration were negotiating over whether Johnson would go to Congress for a tax increase. And Martin was saying, well, I'll hold off on an interest rate increase, but you've got to go to Congress for a tax increase. And I think we were too easy, too long.
Yeah, that's been our mistake most of the time. Well, Lyndon Johnson summoned him down to the Texas White House in December.
Mm-hmm.
Forgotten what year that was exactly.
65.
To blast us on the increase in the discount rate. But the discount rate.
Discount rate went from 4 to 4.5%. So what we viewed as a major policy move, with a later perspective, really wasn't a strong.
Yeah.
Interest rates were very low in those periods.
Yeah,
we argued about whether the interest rate should go from 2.75 to 2.875. And
well, I remember when I came there, I was talking about Mr. Leach, talking about some of his wife's U.S. bond investments, treasury bond investments. During that period, it may have been a little late. I just, you know, sat around that table a lot of years. But I don't think Martin ever willingly subjugated the fight against inflation. I picked out what the appropriate level of interest rates is. How do you know when you got them? It's the same right now. Apparently, Al and Wayne Angel thought we ought to, I'm gathering one of these, thought we ought to tightening action. And others were less convinced, and as usual, we probably waited too late.
And until February 70.
Yeah, that's not right.
So, among all the FOMC members, Martin was clearly a dominant.
No question. He dominated that more than anybody has ever done, but in a very democratic kind of way, except for Burns. And Burns was an old autocrat. He just simply wouldn't let you dissent. And I've never seen Martin rude to anybody in a meeting. Jim Parthema said one time he jumped on Howard Hackley, who was the general counsel and one of the finest people as an assistant. Burns now was so afraid that Hayes was going to be a second Benjamin Strong or Alan Sproul that he sat on him every time. Very rude to him on many occasions. And I've seen him. And I think his intentions were very good. But boy, the policy we had, because he would tolerate no dissent. I remember his first meeting when he stated that he really thought the important thing was to control bank credit. because that's really all he could control, and he was de-emphasizing money, the money supply, anything else. His views evolved, but I'm not exactly sure. But that was his initial statement. I remember so well, Jim Parthemus and I went to that meeting. Aubrey was out of town. And I went to that meeting. I remember Jim and I were speculating on the way up the street what it would be like, on the way up the road what it would be like. And the first thing he said at the meeting was, "Gentlemen, there's going to be a drastic change in the format of the meeting." And Jim and I thought, well, here we go, three members and nobody else there. And he said, at 11 o'clock, we'll have a coffee break. Now, I remember on the way back, Jim and I were laughing about that. Jim said, well, I'll tell you one thing. A guy that leads in a coffee break to a market committee can't be all that bad. And I was very fond of Burns as a person. I wouldn't give him good marks on policy, but after he went as ambassador to West Germany, I remember he wrote back, "Oh, indeed a true friend. Yours is the warmest, most cordial letter." We were good friends, but there were a lot of things about him I didn't like.
The system was moving toward reserve control.
Yeah,
at the
that's right.
Before Burns.
That's right.
But he thought money velocity was completely unstable. It would jump around for psychological reasons,
yeah.
And
I think
he lifted interest rates.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Much. You said Martin cared primarily about inflation, but Burns, I mean, he really thought he could balance off unemployment and inflation. He thought he could control, push the unemployment rate down.
He sort of had a Phillips curve in his thinking. Really.
It's interesting because he wasn't a Keynesian.
No.
But yet he thought that you could...
He was an institutionalist, I guess, more than anything else. You know, he believed in distilling, because of his work at the National Bureau, huge amounts of empirical information and drawing conclusions from it. And I remember several times he would talk to the committee and say, now this is something that I carry very carefully, and he had, related to business cycle. Still say that, not in a irritating manner, but rather in a manner of saying, this is my field of expertise. I really looked into it. Wrestler, you're not that familiar with it. But it wasn't the kind of thing that would irritate you, because he was right. He was right on that. He had spent more time looking at it than anybody else. It bothered me what he did.
But there was no one who could challenge him intellectually in the system, or at least he wouldn't let anyone. He wouldn't let the staff. So that was a problem, because
absolutely.
There was no one who could say, no, look, this is not right.
Yeah, there were plenty of people that were his intellectual equals or superiors, but he would just squelch you. That's all there was to it. He ran it like a graduate seminar where the students didn't have much freedom. The professor's voice was the authority. It was bad. It was very undemocratic. And Volcker, in contrast, was very democratic. I never saw Volcker show any irritation at anybody or treat anybody rudely at a meeting at all. Burns frequently. Oh, now, I don't know what. My first dissent was recorded when he was there on a telephone conference when I was filling in for Dave Eastman. No, Ed Bainey, who was on vacation. I dissented, and Mark Willis dissented, and that started him on that. Being ahead of W, they called it alphabetically. I dissented first, and then Mark dissented, and then he became known as the great dissenter. That was the term applied to him, because he dissented all the rest of the time, which I would have done if I'd been voting, but we live in Philadelphia.
That's Mark Willis.
Yeah. Mark Willis is a good man. It's worrisome to whoever was chairman that people dissented, which was a very good development.
How did Burns and St. Louis get along? That must have been a great source of dissension, because
he was very rude to Darrell Francis. He had no tolerance at all for his statements. Darrell would read long statements, all in the monetarist vein, written by
Homer Jones.
And then Homer's successors were monarchists too. But Darrell didn't present that very well. And it was very persuasive, and Burns couldn't stand him. And I think Burns really ran him out of the system. I've never been completely sure whether the board of directors of the St. Louis Bank recommended him for a 5-year appointment. You know, the president's appointed and first vice president, 5-year terms, and the board of governors got approval every 5 years, routinely. But I do not know the answer to that for sure. And down the recommendation that Darrell be reappointed, so he retired early. I mouthed what his research staff gave him. Everybody at St. Louis has been a monarchist ever since. And Homer Jones was really the one who got all this started. More than else, there were some others out there. I wrote my dissertation there for the money supply. Norm, I always thought the money supply made more sense, but I hadn't quite reached the point that I had given up hope that we could ever fine-tune it and put it on automatic pilot, which I subsequently came to believe was the only reasonable thing to do. It was sort of a matter of pragmatism that led me to that point, which was perfectly compatible with my conservative position that I always had. But actually from you fellows in the research department taught me so much relative to what I needed, not only in the absolute sense, but relative to what I
Getting back to Burns. Burns also viewed himself as a presidential counselor and
took great pride in that.
Wanted to be included in all kinds of policy discussions in Washington. Yeah. Knew everyone. Was his political sensitivity ultimately a problem? Did he handle that differently than Martin? Martin was sensitive to concerns too.
I would say Burns was a much more political animal, really. He was much more fascinated by politics. He'd like to be right in the middle of all political decisions. And it was borne out even in his memorial service, which I attended, where he had Ford, Nixon, and Booker. And I believe one more president.
Perhaps.
I don't think so.
We can check.
But you know, somewhere in the program.
I have that.
Yeah, but it was really impressive. And I remember Nixon, if I'm not mistaken, it was Nixon spoke entirely without notes. He loved to be the trusted advisor of presidents. That was something that really got him. I remember when you know, he'd been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. That was his first major governmental position. That was under Nixon, I guess.
Eisenhower,
was it? Okay. I remember when we had his retirement party, John Ballas, when the Reserve Bank presidents gave him his retirement party, John Ballas was chairman of the Conference of Presidents, and I was vice chairman, and John asked me if I could pick him up and take him to the university club where we were giving him a dinner farewell dinner that we financed. Picking him up consisted of going over to the board and having the board driver drive us over, and then I came back with him. And while we were at the dinner, Bob Mayo, who was president of Chicago then, had been director of the Bureau of the Budget, got up and told a story about a time they'd been discussing what ought to be done about some rather significant public expenditure. Bob Mayo made a proposal. It was probably a little more than he felt really ought to permitted. Bobby Burns is saying, gentlemen, I think we have caught the director of the Bureau of the Budget in a very generous mood. I suggest we accept his. On the way back, Burns was talking in the car with me, and he said, you know, it's really kind of scary to think that we were talking about $200 or $300 million there in that cavalier fashion. And that's the way Nixon was. He talked fiscal austerity, but he was really a big spender. And it was all I could do to bite my tongue. I think it was deliberate. I think it was, again, an era of the post-inflation, bitterly post-inflation, but also was weighing this against whatever his problem.
Politically, how is he different from Martin? I mean, they were both very successful in moving rapidly to the top of organizations and government. I mean, in their own ways, they were extraordinarily capable and entrepreneurial. But I mean, Burns had a fascination with power and politics that Martin didn't go. It went to Burns's. It affected Burns's personality in a way that it didn't affect Martin's.
I think that is absolutely clear. They really did. I think Martin did it through personal magnetism and great leadership abilities. As I told you, I don't think I've ever seen a greater man. Burns kind of bludgeoned his way. But he was not a comfortable sort of person. People listened to him. He could command attention. Martin did it through charm, and Burns did it through a very old other thing in Burns. But I did think a lot of Burns. But I think he was a patriot. I think he always had the country's best interests at heart. But sometimes his personal agenda may have clouded his vision, but I don't think it ever happened to Martin. It's just kind of hard to criticize anything about Martin. Really is. Martin was a registered Democrat, but you know, Democrats in those days were better than Republicans today. That's a sad commentary. Bobby, it's interesting. This relates to my rather dismal outlook for the future of this house 24 years ago, and I remember telling Mary we prayed from us sometime or another. So we really ought to go ahead and do it and enjoy it while we can. I haven't been there that long yet.
Mm. Well, how would you characterize Burns's advocacy of wage and price controls and his head of Committee on Interest and Dividends? And
I think that was a terrible mistake for him to do that. But again, you know, he wanted to be in the middle of everything. He may have had some pressure brought to bear on him, but I think he probably secretly, I'm guessing now, Jim may see it differently, probably secretly wanted to have that kind of thing. But I think he probably thought, and I may be unfair to him, that they would help in a marginal way, but he was not the kind who really would have been a strong advocate of controls like that. I never would have agreed to, but that's what he did, I think.
As head of the Committee on Interest and Dividends, he was quite aggressive in getting after banks who raised rates.
I tell you, that was a political animal, let me tell you, right down to the way he may well have, I don't know that he did, and he probably didn't, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility to think that he might have suggested how he would like his memorial service to be done and all these important figures. They extolled his many virtues very well, and you got a feeling this was a great patriot who had gone, and the world was a whole lot worse off with his being glad when, I wasn't glad when they replaced him with Miller, but when Boca took the Miller's place. I was talking to Burns about that. I said, "Mr. Chairman, I hate to see you go because, you know, you know."
I'll see. Burns wanted to be reappointed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And surely, if he'd been reappointed, policy would have been tighter much.
Yeah.
Much sooner, we never would have been through the early 80s, all that.
I think that's right.
On the other hand, during the year 77, when he wanted to be reappointed, policy was too easy again.
Well, there was a good series of articles on that thing. Dave Eastburn, and I mentioned one ago, former president of Philadelphia, wrote an article explaining in part why that was true. We had bad money supply figures there. Those things were revised upward a great deal from what we had at the time we were working on policy. The data was just not good, and they didn't show as much monetary expansion as was really taking place. So else, he defended the chairman, which defended the system, I guess, primarily. He, he wasn't inclined to defend the chairman because the chairman thought Dave was too liberal, and he kind of put the screws down on him. He retired early in part to get out from under Burns, whom he couldn't stand. And I remember after Burns retired, they tried to establish a research position. I don't know what they called it, at the American Enterprise Institute, and they asked all of us to contribute. And Dave asked me one day if I'd given any money to him. And I said, did you? He said, hell no.
That's funny.
I remember, couldn't stand the guy. I never disliked him, though, but despite disagreeing with him on a lot of occasions. So he was determined to put Dewey Dane into Richmond Bank. I was an unknown quantity to him.
That was
Burns. And so after Aubrey died in January, they wouldn't go along with me until August of that year. And I was out in Minneapolis attending a conference at Penn Bank, and if the board would approve. I think what happened was, I attended all those meetings, and I think he, kind of looked me over, and he decided that I'd probably be an ally on conservative issues. He knew I was a conservative at that time, and he always thought I would be an ally, not an enemy. And by that time, we can be kind of buddies, and so he decided I wouldn't be all that bad. And the Richmond Bank wasn't wrong with you for various reasons that I won't go into. I think we say he's a Keynesian, and he's a conservative Keynesian, is what he is. And I think he would still like, and that was my position. And I have a good framework, but the way I ran up against the problem was when policy, when you had to know the appropriate level of interest rates, and I could figure out when you could do that. And so I said, there'd be another way. And that just leads you into looking at you're putting out to finance the economy, and don't put out too much. And then when you see the lags and the inability to change at the right time, that conservative more and more towards putting it on automatic pilot to the extent you can. I don't know what we do now, Bob. You've got to come up with something.
Well, I think it's much of what we've always done. I think the FOMC has a lot of pragmatic, practical-minded person. They have a lot of contacts in the business community. They follow the economy. And they think they have a common sense, intuitive feeling for what interest rates ought to be doing, given what the economy's doing. And sometimes it works, and other times it works very, very badly, especially when the Fed thinks that it can temporize or accommodate or put off an interest rate increase because it's facing political pressure. It thinks, well, it's okay, we can wait a little bit and get it through later, and then
I can understand that, as long as you don't wait to the point that it's done some damage. That is human nature to do that. Some good conservatives that didn't dissent with Al. I doubt that Tom Melzer was voting, but I'm sure he was sympathetic to Al's dissent.
I think people accord. They give the chairman the benefit of the doubt. They realize he has problems.
Yeah,
and I think they realize, especially when the Fed has stopped moving interest rates down and has to begin moving them up, I think they realize that the chairman has to have some support within the political system, some understanding.
Yeah.
And it takes him some time to develop that. And I think the committee members are willing to give the chairman some latitude for when it's all right to begin moving rates up.
I think that's exactly right.
And sometimes they've let it go too long.
Most often we've let it go too long. I've had the Greenspan admit.
Has he ever said anything to you about 87 when he came in? He came in at a very difficult time. Inflation expectations had really gotten out of control. Volcker was good, but Volcker was political too, and
much more so than Greenspan. Much more
in
so.
In the middle, he
and not as ardent an inflationist.
He was he he believed inflation should be low, but he also believed you could fine tune at a lower level of inflation. And I believe that in the mid 80s, he thought that the economy was under enough stress, particularly in the Midwest, that protectionist sentiment was to the point where the political system could bring down the free trade system. And he thought Germany and Japan had to get their economies going. We had to do something about our balance of payments deficit. And given the kinds of political pressures that the Fed was under, and particularly the strains to the system of free trade, we were too easy, too long. When Volcker went out, inflation expectations were on the rise, and Greenspan didn't have, at that point, he didn't have the credibility that Volcker had. Volcker could put off, I think, because he had an enormous credibility still, though. And then when he wasn't reappointed, Greenspan came in without that credibility, but in a very difficult situation, and it would be very interesting to get his thoughts on.
I remember his. I mentioned him one time that I had descended. I descended 5 out of 8 times the last 2 times that I voted. He said, "You descended that much?" Okay. I said, "Yeah, I really felt like we might strong, just going too fast, and we were laying." Paul agrees with you too easy about getting one of these periods.
It's interesting, the period where Manny Johnson and Wayne Angel came in, and then you had the Vice Chairman Martin.
Angel was an easy money man when he first got there.
They took over the discount rate and pushed the funds rate down against what the FOMC wanted to do.
Manny Johnson was a very weak person, really. Terms of his commitment and his intellectual analysis, I think, really.
Probably the most political vice chairman we've ever had.
That's right. And I guess it's sort of like you're going to have with Blind, I hope. Well, I don't know. He's probably going to become more conservative the longer he stays on. I remember when Wayne got there, he said, "Now the time will come when I'm the tightest member of the board." But at that time, you know, he was pretty easy.
Saw commodity prices falling, and he thought, "This is the 1870s."
That's right.
And he thought he was saving the country. But he was not a person that listened to other people.
Oh Lord, no!
And unfortunately, he's still in trouble because of it.
That's an interesting flap about his. Question that Gonzalez raised about whether he'd use inside information. I would have made this of my knowledge of the people involved. And
that's right. But he didn't say this as a guess. He just said
I never saw the thing, and I gather that's what he'd done, which was a dumb move.
Oh, it was
terribly dumb.
Yeah, if he had spent more time trying to learn about the system rather than trying to reinvent it himself, I think he never could have made that kind of mistake, but he thought he could reinvent how everybody looked at things.
I was in a real dilemma when he retired. I wanted to write and tell him I really appreciated his stand against inflation. Mm-hmm. It would have been so conspicuous that I had not admitted that I had omitted all the other things he was involved in, none of which I thought he did very well.
And decentralized the system. He didn't believe in a federal Federal Reserve system. Mm-hmm.
And so I just didn't write him anything.
Yeah,
I read his letter now. I always got Larry Kudlow. Well, for years I've gotten Larry Kudlow's letter, and they continued to send it to me. All he ever had was an undergraduate degree.
That's right.
I thought he had a master's and was working on his dissertation and never finished dissertation, but he never got beyond undergraduate school.
He was one of those people who could just network and meet important people and make the right contacts. And of course, Greenspan was that way too.
It's
very surprising. He comes across as very low-key. But throughout his whole life, he always knew how to meet the right people.
Absolutely. He got there. I don't suppose anybody else will ever get there by any other route either. It plays a real role. But in terms of affection among the people in the system, nobody ever matched Martin much, much more personal affection towards him and respect than anybody else. And I'd say really, I guess it's kind of hard to separate my own views. I expect most people say Voca had the second greatest amount, but Voca was much softer on Blazin than Greenspan, and Greenspan, a couple of people, and I just like Greenspan a lot better than Voca myself.
Voca was so dominating intellectually,
yeah.
And he could, he basically did what he wanted to, but the committee supported him because they thought he was doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Until, of course, you got this combination of Preston Martin, Manny Johnson, Win Angel, and Martha Seeger, and then they went their own way.
Off of the case, I'll tell you.
Well, actually, considering the Reagan appointees, it's surprising that monetary policy was as good as it was, considering what
lousy.
We got.
They were lousy.
Yeah.
In general, they were lousy.
Johnson was pretty smart. Manuel Johnson, pretty articulate.
Well, he rambled an awful lot. He started talking before he thought about what he was going to say.
Yeah.
Kind of like Bob Mayo. Bob Mayo never looked up from the table. He just talked, and I don't think Bob had the foggiest idea what he was going to say when he started. And we used to, Al and I, and Jim was Al, but Al and I used to.
Who was the president from Cleveland? I remember Parthemus or Al trying to talk about his statements and just saying, well, potholes. He talked about potholes, and he'd go from the international to the domestic. That was before, it would have been before Karen Horn.
That was John Ballas?
No, he was San Francisco.
Oh, sure.
Ballas was usually pretty good.
Well, he was from Cleveland, yeah.
Willis
is a nice guy, but Willis was miscast, hopelessly miscast. I remember he had a favorite expression of, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we're asking ourselves the right question. When Burns was there, he said, you know, really, we're worrying about the energy shortage, but power is almost a practical reality. And Burns said, really? He said, I didn't know. I always say, talking about what the money supply was doing, I wonder if we ask that. I mean, that's an absurd example, but it was always something that really wasn't all that relevant.
Yeah.
But his favorite expression, but a nice, nice guy. I get a long Christmas card from him. I remember he did dissent at times when he should have dissented, and I sat next to him. I remember leaning over to him and said, Willis, you can be proud of that dissent someday. I dissented right. But he was a very unhappy person. They always were doing things that he was trying to load up his car with food and take it around to poor people. Yeah, and in Cleveland. I'm so well. When he did it actually at Philadelphia, when he was chairman of the board there, it was more than that. He was really, you know, was a very caring person and a very fine person.
Mm-hmm.
He's just miscast. I wrote a book, I think I had as a textbook in a course in investments I took one time. And it was a deadly tome if I but he fancied himself an investment expert. You know, he was in the period when I guess Wharton was at its peak in reputation. Yeah, when Jim Tucker got his PhD, he always talked about his old. I'm not going to tell you, Jim, the old dean. He's always miscasting in his last incarnation. With the last Christmas cards that Willis said that they had stopped paying any portion of the medical insurance for the retirees, which is not guaranteed, but I think most retirees would have said that would happen in all other churches. But under Jerry Jordan, in an effort to get the cost down to the lowest level, did that. And Willis was really kind of incensed about that.
Sure.
Yeah. It was an implied fundraiser.